we felt that that taking the step of bisecting the wilderness with this road was irrevocable.
A big setback for the access road proposal for King Cove. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Tuesday, February 5th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, an oil and gas trade association offers a new case for opening up ANWR.
The only bright spot of this economy in this recession has been energy production.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. If you're interested in serving on your local Federal Subsistence Regional Advisory Council, the deadline to apply is Monday, February 18. The councils provide information to the Federal Subsistence Board on subsistence hunting, trapping, and fishing. For more information on the advisory councils and how to apply, call 1-800-478-1456 or email subsistence@fws.gov. This message sponsored by U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service.
The U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service came out against a controversial proposed road through the Eisenbeck National Wildlife Refuge today. Residents of the Aleutian community of King Cove are disappointed, but as KUCB's Stephanie Joyce reports, they're not giving up on the project.
Locals have been lobbying for a road to connect King Cove and the all-weather airport at Cold Bay for decades. They say it would save lives by making medevacs safer. But environmental activists have consistently opposed the project, contending it would devastate critical habitat for migratory birds. In a 2,000-page-plus environmental impact statement, the Fish and Wildlife Service came down on the side of the activists. Agency spokesperson Bruce Woods says given the uniqueness of the habitat, a proposal to exchange state and tribal lands for the roadway simply didn't pass muster.
We felt that that taking the step of bisecting the wilderness with this road was irrevocable.
Wood says the decision takes into account not only the direct impact on species, but also the consequences of increased accessibility to refuge lands.
It was the impacts to the, which was somewhat more ephemeral, but the wilderness character of the lands by having the road through it, as I said, which once it's done, is done.
Residents didn't take the news well. King Cove Corporation Administrator Della Trumbull says she's outraged.
This is a slap in the face. It's a bird over human life.
As things stand, medevacs from King Cove are by air when weather permits and by private vessel or Coast Guard helicopter when planes can't land. There used to be hovercraft service between King Cove and Cold Bay, but the Aleutians East Borough suspended it in 2010, citing high cost and unreliability. In its decision, the Fish and Wildlife Service supports a different proposal by the borough to operate a landing craft between the communities. But Trumbull says that simply won't work because of the area's bad weather.
The reliability of anything else beside a road is just not there.
King Cove Mayor Henry Mack agrees. He says it feels like the Fish and Wildlife Service didn't pay attention to the community's concerns. Although the final decision on the road rests with the Secretary of the Interior, Mack is pretty sure the community has lost this round. But he sees it as just one more chapter in the decades-long saga, and he plans to keep fighting.
We have not given up. We have a very strong King Cove group, we call it. We have a supportive Senator Mikulski and Begich, Representative Don Young, very strong folks who fight for this here. So we're still in it yet. We'll just see where it goes here.
Alaska's congressional delegation came out unanimously against the Fish and Wildlife Service today. Representative Don Young says he plans to introduce legislation to force the federal government to exchange lands so that the road can be built.
You know, people's lives are important. The idea that they're saying now they're looking at another alternative, none of the above, but the alternative they're looking at is an aluminum landing craft. Well, I'll tell you what, a flat-bottom landing craft going across that water mass in high storms is just as dangerous as going across with an airplane. So it's not a good decision.
Senator Lisa Murkowski is still holding out hope that Secretary of the Interior Ken Salazar will override the Fish and Wildlife Service. Ultimately, it's up to Salazar to make a determination about whether the road is in the public interest.
I am hopeful that given sufficient pressure, he will look at this, he will weigh the considerations, and he will equally value the lives and the safety of the people of King Cove. At the same time that he's looking to protection of a refuge.
A spokesperson for the Department of the Interior refused to comment on a timeline for that decision or on whether Secretary Salazar will make it before leaving office later this spring. With help from APRN's Peter Granitz, I'm Stephanie Joyce.
The U.S. Environmental Protection Agency plans to issue a final report this year on the impacts of large-scale mining in the Bristol Bay region. That's according to Regional Director Dennis McLaren. EPA last year released a draft watershed assessment which underwent peer review. Some panelists raised concerns about things like missing data and incomplete information. EPA announced in November that it would address the concerns raised by the panel, first with a revised draft. McLaren, in prepared remarks to the Alaska Forum on the Environment, says the agency is arranging to have the original experts review the revised assessment and evaluate whether it is responsive to their comments. EPA plans to release the draft to the public for comment concurrently. A new report from an oil and gas trade association is predicting a windfall for Alaska if the government opened federally owned lands and water to drilling. APRN's Peter Granitz reports.
The Institute for Energy Research estimates as many as 61,000 new jobs could be created from opening the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge alone. That's a number that could catch the eyes of lawmakers who hold the fate of drilling in Anwar. Tom Pyle is the president of IER. He says his group is counting spillover jobs, too.
In manufacturing, in healthcare, in real estate, construction, arts and entertainment, food services, you know, that when you look at this stuff, you have to look at the big economic picture, not just, you know, what the jobs that are created from drilling a well or putting it in the Trans-Alaska pipeline.
His group's report looks beyond the added revenue from lease sales. The nonpartisan Congressional Budget Office looked into potential lease sales in August, and the CBO estimated future royalties as high as $50 billion from opening Anwar. But IER did not want to stop with lease sales, so it introduced potential new jobs and increased wages. Pyle estimates opening Anwar would lead to an extra $3 million in wages each year. The report comes on the same day President Obama called on Congress to pass a small package of spending cuts and tax increases to stave off harsh across-the-board cuts slated for March 1st.
These modest reforms in our social insurance programs have to go hand in hand with a process of tax reform so that the wealthiest individuals and corporations can't take advantage of loopholes and deductions that aren't available to most Americans.
The president did not single out preferable tax treatment for oil and gas companies this time, but he has in the past. Pyle says federal leasing for the oil and gas industry is the strongest way to close the burgeoning deficit.
The only bright spot in this economy in this recession has been energy production. And there's no reason other than political will why we can't see that benefit in other states like Alaska.
While there have been huge increases in shale drilling in places like North Dakota, Pennsylvania, and Texas, they all took time. Energy economist Ed Herz cautions about rosy outlooks for a quick windfall if the federal government started leasing Anwar or the Outer Continental Shelf.
It's going to take 7 to 15 years to finish the seismic review, the geological review, and then began to develop the technological aspects of building the play.
Herz, who is also the managing director of Hill House Resources, an independent oil and gas company in Houston, says Alaska should look to deep water examples in the Gulf of Mexico.
Thunder Horse, from start to production, was a 12-year run, and wasn't in nearly the difficult conditions one's going to find offshore Alaska.
Tom Pyle concedes an Anwar bill is unlikely to make it through Congress this term, but that does not mean you won't hear many Republicans and pro-oil Democrats tout the new study. In Washington, D.C., I'm Peter Granitz.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, Hugh Neff makes it to Dawson first in the Yukon Quest, but tips his hat to his closest competitor.
He's definitely been taking more rest and just waiting. You know, he really wants to win after last year.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by BP, supporting public broadcasting in Alaska, and by Wells Fargo, extending its support of Alaska residents beyond banking by supporting the programming of public radio throughout Alaska, giving back to the community. Wells Fargo, together we'll go far.
Two identical bills in the State House and Senate seek the creation of a state fund to supplement toll revenue shortfalls related to the Kinnick Arm Bridge in the initial years after the bridge is constructed. That is, if the bridge linking Wasilla and Anchorage ever becomes reality. As KSKA's Ellen Lockyer reports, there are still serious concerns about the cost of the bridge.
Senate Minority Leader Johnny Ellis wrote to Kinnick Arm Bridge and Toll Authority Executive Director Andrew Nemec in December, requesting cost updates relating to recent changes to the bridge plan. One of Ellis's concerns is the increased span of the bridge from 8,200 feet to 9,200 feet as a result of agreements with the City of Anchorage on the city-side approach. Ellis points out that bridge cost estimates dating to 2007 do not reflect the extra length. Shannon McCarthy is a public affairs manager for Kubota. She says the extra length is a trade-off. The plan has changed to remove the amount of fill used in the bridge approaches to protect habitat. She admits the extra length adds to the cost of the project.
The cost difference is about $15 million to make that change, or roughly 2% of the overall Phase 1 construction cost.
Critics of the Kinnick Arm Bridge say that the financial plan for the project does not match current realities. Kubota opponents, like Anchorage resident Bob French, says that the bridge costs presented by Kubota authorities are skewed.
I think really what we need to see is a financial plan that has realistic sources of revenue and of realistic loans. And so far, Kubota hasn't provided that.
French is one of the authors of a website called Kinnick Bridge Facts. He says Kubota authorities have not addressed the costs of defining how and how deep to drive the bridge pilings into the soft, shifting clay on the Anchorage side.
It could be the difference between having a couple hundred feet long versus having, 100 feet long. There's a cost risk there that hasn't been identified in their cost estimates.
McCarthy says measurements of the various materials underneath the bridge have been taken along the length of the bridge for depth and for the material's effects on the pilings.
So we've done those two measurements, and we're providing those results to whoever the successful bidder will be, whoever the successful design and construction company will be. They will then, therefore, be responsible for doing any additional drilling, and they are ultimately responsible for the design and the construction. So they're taking on that risk of design and construction.
French also says that Kubota was turned down for a federal transportation loan, which represents about half the money for bridge construction. But McCarthy counters that the procedures for loan approval under the Transportation Infrastructure Finance and Innovation Act are to blame. She says loan approval is pending.
We don't have to apply again. We're actually in line, and as soon as we get all the information that they have requested, we can move forward.
And French says future bridge toll revenue projections are based on a future four-lane highway, when initial construction will only provide two lanes. McCarthy says toll projections are based on the number of cars crossing the bridge, not on the number of highway lanes. Andrew Nemec has responded to Ellis's letter, saying that updated 2010 estimates put the cost of Phase 1 of bridge construction at $706 million. Nemec says that Federal Highway Administration reviews on actual costs are slated to be released sometime later this year. I'm Ellen Lockyer.
The first two teams have arrived at the halfway point along the Yukon Quest Trail. Hugh Neff came in first. He'll win 4 ounces of gold if he makes it all the way to Fairbanks. Alan Moore's team came trotting into the checkpoint chute 2 hours later. Neff maintains that Moore's is the team to beat.
He's definitely been taking more rest and just waiting. He really wants to win after last year, so.
KUAC's Emily Schwing is in Dawson City. She watched both teams arrive. Hi, Emily.
Hi, Lori.
Emily, how did Neff and Moore's dogs look when the teams arrived?
Well, Hugh Neff's team looked strong but tired. I was hoping for wagging tails, but we didn't get any. But their ears did perk up, and they were looking around at the crowd of about 50 people that had gathered to see him come in. And they were eating well when they got snacked after they came in to shoot. Alan's team just came trotting around the corner down the street, and straight into the checkpoint. They looked happy to be there. He did have a dog in the bag, but her name is Scooter, and she apparently had a shoulder problem. But other than that, everybody looks pretty good and pleased to be here in Dawson.
Emily, Neff and Moore have very different strategies as mushers. Can you describe that dynamic for us?
Yeah, so Hugh Neff doesn't run any mid-distance races. He trains his dog specifically to run in 1,000-mile races. So he runs a little bit of a different schedule, these long, slow runs. He also hasn't been resting his dogs very much. There's a lot of speculation about whether or not he can maintain the lead that he has. Running for as long as he is and resting his dogs for as little as he is. As far as Alan Moore's team goes, training, he does run a lot of mid-distance races, so he rests for longer than Hugh Neff does, but he also runs a schedule that is about 6 hours of running and then 4 hours of rest somewhere in there. And he's, you know, he seems to be maintaining that.
The race officials have taken American Summit out of the race. It's icy. How do you think the new race route, avoiding American Summit, will affect the leaders?
Well, that's a really interesting question. A lot of people are wondering whether or not it will benefit them. I think as far as Hugh Neff and Alan Moore go, either way, they'll have strong runs into Eagle. For Brent Sass, though, it's a little bit of a disappointment. His dogs really do excel on big climbs that are dominated sometimes by bad weather. And I think he also personally enjoys the adventure. So I know he was a little bit disappointed about that change in the race. And then, you know, for mushers like Lance Mackey, who are experiencing some difficulty along the race trail, the reroute might actually really, really benefit him. He's down to 9 dogs, and so they'll need any extra help that they can get.
Well, Emily, give us a little more of an update on Lance Mackey. He won the first running of the Top of the World 350 in December and was very optimistic about how things were going to go this season. It sounds like he is struggling in this race. What's going on?
Yeah, he is struggling, it's really disappointing to see because he was very excited about coming back to the Yukon Quest and seeing what he could do this year again. We'll see what happens here in Dawson. It's traditionally mushers do not scratch when they come into a checkpoint. They make that decision before they leave, and he's got, you know, 36 hours of rest ahead of him to decide what he's going to do. There is some speculation that he may decide to scratch just so that he can regroup for the Iditarod this year.
All right. Thanks, Emily, for that update.
You're welcome.
KUAC reporter Emily Schwing reporting from Dawson on the Yukon Quest Trail.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by ConocoPhillips. The easy oil is gone, and getting to the remaining oil will be a challenge that will require the state and the industry to work together. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company. And by Meridian Management, specializing in coordination and management of all phases of construction projects from vision to completion, working to ensure that your project is on time and on budget. More at meridianak.com. The State of Alaska Department of Revenue reminds you to file online now for your 2013 PFD, or paper applications are located in your community. More information at pfd.alaska.gov. This message sponsored by the State of Alaska.
The Anchorage School Board passed their preliminary budget for next year after hearing testimony from the public. KSKA's Daisha Eaton has the story.
The public packed the Anchorage Education Center to testify about proposed cuts to support staff at the Anchorage School District. Many testified that school counselors should not be cut. Tracy Ashman is a counselor at Diamond High School who works with many special education students.
Since Christmas, the Anchorage School District has had 3 student suicides. My job is to intervene, and it's a critical role in student safety. The argument will be made that these crises can be handled through community resources. Unfortunately, crises cannot be scheduled, and this is very unrealistic.
Students also testified. Ebony Brown, a senior at Service High School, said high school counselors should not be cut because of the critical role they play.
If you're going to make budget cuts, don't cut the counselors. They're like the moms of high school. They have the soothing words, they can calm people down, and they take charge like a mother would. And like a little, their little lion cubs, they want to see them progress and succeed and actually like survive in the educational world.
Emily McKenzie, who is in the Ignite Gifted program at Baxter Elementary, said she was worried about the cuts to the program, which has become so important to her learning.
Ignite shows kids different ways of thinking from different kids at different schools. And if we stop busing and cut things in Ignite, then kids won't have that opportunity.
Jessica Stern is a teacher at the Newcomers Center. She said she's concerned about cuts to English language learner counselors, especially where she works.
Without having a counselor at the Newcomers Center, basically we're a ship without a captain. And I would not be able to teach from when the bell rings to when it stops if I don't have a counselor there to support me.
Leanne Minster spoke in support of career resource counselors.
The quest for information about colleges, financial aid, scholarships is overwhelming. The CRC staff is as much a resource to the parent as to the student. I'm going through this daunting task myself with a senior, and I realize the value of these resources in the CRC. It is a full-time job, and it directly impacts the opportunities our graduates will have post-secondary education. And I remind you that when our kids lose, we all lose.
Dale Miller spoke out against cuts to the ASD warehouse and maintenance departments where he works.
Cuts to preventive maintenance only increases costs down the road. You know, if we're looking to the taxpayers when we go out and bond for major maintenance, we ought to at least be showing them that we're being responsible, trying to maintain the investment up front.
In all, nearly 50 people testified. The school board passed the preliminary budget 6-1 with Tam Agosti-Giesler the only nay vote. School board members tasked the superintendent and his staff with answering a dozen or so questions they had about the budget within the next few days. School board president Jeannie Mackey said, despite the impassioned testimony of so many, that she did not expect to make many amendments to the budget. The school board will take their final vote on the budget on February 21st. In Anchorage, I'm Daisha Eaton.
Several earthquakes have shaken up southeast Alaska since last fall. KSTK's Shady Grove Oliver spoke with an earthquake physicist about why these latest quakes are of particular interest to scientists.
On the evening of October 27, 2012, a magnitude 7.7 earthquake shook coastal British Columbia. The epicenter of the quake was in Haida Gwaii, formerly known as the Queen Charlotte Islands. It was the third largest recorded earthquake in Canada. David Oglesby, professor of geophysics at the University of California, Riverside, explains why this particular quake caught scientists' attention.
In southern Alaska and in Canada is what's called a transform plate boundary, and it typically involves faulting that is horizontal, what's called strike-slip faulting, very similar to what you get in Southern California and Central California on the San Andreas Fault. And so those are the kinds of earthquakes that we expect to see in your region. This earlier event, the magnitude 7.7 west of Queen Charlotte Island, was not that type of earthquake.
An earthquake is when the tectonic plates that make up the Earth's crust scrape against each other along fault lines. Most earthquakes in southeast Alaska are the type that involve strike-slip faulting.
The best way to think about it is take a map and draw a line on it, and then cut along that line, and then slide the two portions of the map horizontally past each other. It involves horizontal slipping on a relatively vertical fault.
The Himalayas are the highest mountains in the world. They were created by the other type of fault movement, called thrusting. This is the kind of quake that happened off of Haida Gwaii last year.
You had one plate thrusting underneath the other, so the two plates are actually pushing together.
Now, we fast forward to this year's January 4th quake that happened off the coast of Craig in southeast Alaska. It was an example of strike-slip faulting, but Oglesby says the two quakes might be related. He says the first thing that tipped scientists off is that the two quakes happened in the same region in a relatively short period of time. To find out more, scientists are looking at what happened with the forces inside the Earth's crust during these two events.
So you can look at how the rocks moved around in the first earthquake, and when rocks move around inside the Earth, then they redistribute forces in the Earth, and so they change the forces on nearby faults.
Sometimes the rocks move around in such a way that they take pressure off of the other faults and reduce the likelihood of more earthquakes happening. In other cases, the rocks jam up against each other, aggravating the already smashed faults and increasing the chance of a second earthquake. He says preliminary analysis of these two recent quakes leads scientists to believe the Haida Gwaii quake did put more pressure on the nearby fault and helped trigger the Alaska quake.
That's what I mean by there being a connection between the two earthquakes. That's not to say that the second earthquake wouldn't have happened by itself eventually, but it's possible that it was moved forward in time by a certain number of years due to this earlier earthquake a little bit farther south.
But there's another reason scientists are paying special attention to the Haida Gwaii quake. Southeast Alaska's typical strike-slip faulting can cause a lot of ground shaking, but it isn't as potentially dangerous for coastal communities as a thrusting earthquake.
Because a tsunami is generated whenever you can lift up or throw down a whole bunch of water. And so an earthquake that has a significant component of vertical motion can lift up or throw down the seafloor, whereas an earthquake that involves mostly horizontal motion tends not to have as much of a tsunami potential.
The Haida Gwaii quake did cause some tsunami activity, and Oglesby says the region got lucky this time. It can be easy to forget about earthquakes when they're not happening, but Oglesby says it's important for Southeast Alaska to pay attention.
Well, I think these two earthquakes that have happened along your plate boundary are a reminder that in southeastern Alaska, you are in earthquake country. And so while we cannot predict when or where the next substantial earthquake is going to take place, we know it has to happen. And we know that the effects can be very, very strong. So it's a little bit of a wake-up call for us, I believe.
He will be presenting his research on the Canadian and Alaskan earthquakes at the Seismological Society of America meeting this spring. Reporting in Wrangell, I'm Shady Grove Oliver.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. You can follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Stephanie Joyce in Unalaska, Ellen Lockyer and Daisha Eaton in Anchorage, Emily Schwing on the Yukon Quest Trail, and Shady Grove Oliver in Wrangell. APRN's Peter Granitz reported from Washington, D.C. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Josh Edge is our web producer. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible in part by your local public radio station. If you're interested in serving on your local Federal Subsistence Regional Advisory Council, the deadline to apply is Monday, February 18. Email subsistence@fws.gov for more information. This message sponsored by U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. Regardless of where you live, you've got a better shot at earning the Alaska Performance Scholarship by enrolling in the Alaska Native Science and Engineering Program. ANSEP challenges students with classes that are necessary to earn the scholarship. ANSEP.net. This message sponsored by ANSEP. Every Alaskan can make a difference when we file online for our PFD. You can shelter families in crisis, nourish the hungry and homeless, and protect those who have suffered abuse and neglect. It's easy to share a little of your PFD through Pick, Click, Give, and good things will happen for the causes you care about. Learn more at pickclickgive.org. This message sponsored by the Atwood Foundation, Flint Hills Resources, and Providence, Alaska.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.